from runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 411, IPv6 in 2014, with guest Ed Horley. Recorded Monday, February 16th, 2015. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Ed Horley, back from the wilds. He's the author of The Practical IPv6 for Windows Administrators from APress and a Principal Solutions Architect at Groupware Technology in San Francisco area. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Always great to talk to you, my friend. I would like to think that 2014 was a banner year for IPv6, but was it?
It was. It actually was. Some big milestones. Some milestones coming up, actually, very, very soon, actually, in April, as predicted, Aaron, which is the North American region, Aaron run out to happen. But last year, 2014, we had a lot of activity, and actually, I think the crossing threshold was above 10% of IPv6 utilization, which doesn't seem like a lot.
Well, 10% is sort of a magic number, right? They say once a product reaches 10% penetration, it's actually part of consciousness. Like, that's what retailers look for, is that level of penetration. That's an important number.
Yeah, I think and that's sort of the Google side of what they're seeing for incoming traffic.
Right.
The expectation is actually doubling. So in 2015, by end of 2015, they're predicting between 20 and 25% of traffic.
Wow.
So it's a pretty hard hockey stick at this point. For the uptake. I think the really significant numbers is the fact that folks like, Verizon and T-Mobile and others are all getting significant traffic. Verizon's above 50% on their wireless side on IPv6.
IPv6 on their wireless side. So phones?
Yeah, for phones. So all the phones running around out there are doing the most amount of IPv6. So, so actually the devices that people are using the most often to consume the most content, which is when we're on our phones doing Facebook or, looking up stuff on Google or Yahoo or whatever else, we're doing all those transactions with V6 and not even really knowing it.
I had no idea the phones were running V6 stacks at all. But I guess it makes perfect sense because they've got all the problems of IPv4 and then some. Too many devices in too little area, constantly moving around in their connections. Like, of course, that would be where V6 would thrive.
Yeah, and so it's a pretty significant uptake for 2014. I wouldn't call it a banner in terms of enterprise adoption. I would say enterprise adoption is probably the slowest out of it.
Sure.
So consumer and service providers are all on board and moving rapidly, and the enterprise, as expected, is slower than molasses.
Yeah. But I always figured that as the IPv4 pools ran out, and they are running out, that it would be the providers that would start selling IPv6 as the product. I just figured it would be a bigger promotion item. It's like, be on the new internet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see it as a promotion item. I see it as the we're going to continue to operate item. And you don't necessarily want people to know that you're having to make big changes in order to continue to operate.
Right.
So I'm not surprised that they're not out there touting it as something net new that you need to have. Comcast has very quietly turned it on. It's nationwide. They're the biggest IPv6 traffic contributor today. So.
Wow. But they haven't changed their endpoint at all. Like, their customers are they actually using V6, or is it?
Yeah, their customers. So the new DOCSIS 3 modems that Comcast, has been distributing out, and all the net new turnups that they do, mm-hmm. all have dual stack. So they run both IPv4 and IPv6.
Interesting.
And, John Jason Burkowski, who's over at Comcast, has done a pretty significant job of pushing V6 is solving a lot of Comcast structural problems. So they have been very, very serious, and they are now the largest deployment of V6.
Wow. No idea, because generally speaking, when you talk to the world about Comcast, they do not say nice things.
Well, I'm not saying anything about their service. I'm simply saying some of their technical engineering is maybe a little better than people give them credit for.
That's fair. It's nice to hear, actually. You know, you don't get to be that big a company without being good at something.
Yeah, I would say they've definitely taken the bull by the horns and really tackled V6 as a way they need to address their long-term sort of structural needs. And that's exactly what V6 was intended for, right?
And can you speak to the benefits it's happening to Comcast for this?
Yeah, so Comcast had some, and I won't, you know, speak out of turn. I mean, I've heard John speak publicly.
But oh, okay.
Comcast actually ran out of RFC 1918 space internally.
Oh,
so
wow.
So they ran out of what we would typically refer to as in the V4 world space as, you know, private addressable. And in addition, they were starting to actually have overlapping RFC 1918. So they were actually having a NAT internally for their own RFC 1918. And they were running out of public V4 space. And they were like, how are we going to solve this problem? We have a really serious problem in terms of continuing to operate as a business. And so they decided to do a couple different things, and they wanted to tackle V6 to sort of solve their addressing need problems. And they did that internally first. So actually the first V6 deployments that they did was actually all about their own techs out in the field being able to access resources for their internal equipment. And they actually turned up V6 there first. So sort of a, you know, use it yourself first before you actually deploy it to customers.
Interesting. And because of their size, let's face it, they're a massive organization.
Yeah.
They ran into this issue sort of first.
And they changed a lot of things in the industry, actually. What was remarkable about what Comcast did is that they shared a lot of information back. They did a lot of work with the manufacturers to actually get things changed the way they needed to, in order to be able to operate a network that mm-hmm. large. So they actually pushed the envelope forward in terms of, you know, some very fundamental things that an operator would need in the V6 arena, which I think was pretty important. And, you know, everyone sort of benefited from that. You know, so Time Warner and others who are, you know, Cox Communications, all the other folks are able to piggyback on top of what, you know, sort of the hard work that Comcast sort of pushed out there first.
And yeah, and isn't that just the way, right? I don't want to be first. I'm not going to figure this out myself. But if you figure it out, let me know.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly what they did. It was a big investment, and I think it's paid off for them. So, you know, kudos to John and the rest of the crew.
But it does feel like this is going, IPv6 is going to come out with a whimper, not so much a bang.
Yeah, you know, I never thought that IPv6 was going to come out with a bang.
Yeah.
I did think the adoption was going to happen a little quicker than it did. So, you know.
That's the nature of being a believer, Ed.
Yeah, this is this is true. Let's see, when did my first blog post go up about V6? 2005?
Right.
So here we are 10 years later, and you know, we're at 10% adoption. But I think the good news is that it does solve a lot of problems. I think the issues now, the interesting ones for me anyway, are watching what the cloud providers are going to do. I think Amazon's public V4 address pool is at a 5-year time horizon.
Wow.
If they consume at their current rates, which means, you know, which is probably only going to get faster for them. So who knows?
They're only going to accelerate.
Right. And then same problem structurally for Azure. I mean, what's Azure going to do? You know, when are they going to release V6? Because structurally, there's only so much addressing. They're starting to consume addresses in what people would think is the US region, but they're using address space from other parts of the world. And this is actually causing problems for like content caching and delivery systems, because they think that particular machine or that hosted service is in a different part of the world than what it actually is, even though it's in a US data center. So
yeah, and that's what happens when you have that many IPs available to you too, right? Is that you start being able to cheat, which is really what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's cheating. I wouldn't say it's a bad cheating, but it is cheating. It causes some structural problems for other people. But,
yeah, no, you know, this is a whole lot of BGP entries that people are going to have to deal with to redo those redirects. Like, it's going to create efficiency problems. And you've made assumptions based on the ARN rules about where traffic's supposed to go, and these guys aren't following those rules.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it causes problems actually structurally internally for Microsoft. It's sort of interesting. If you talk to the people in MSIT, so MSIT is going through their sort of 5-year refresh cycles over mm-hmm. the last year and going forward, where they have to either choose that they're going to continue to host on premises for their equipment and need requirements, or they're going to go to Azure.
Right.
Well, Microsoft did a big initiative probably about 3-4 years ago to make everything dual stack. So everything internally within Microsoft and MSIT is all dual stacked. So they fully support IPv4 and IPv6. And then they have the mandate to move into Azure, and they've been supporting V4 and V6 side by side for, you know, years now. And moving into Azure, they lose V6.
That seems crazy to me that they've not just implemented V6 in the Azure stack. What's the big deal?
Well, multicast is a little tougher to do, and multicast is a requirement for V6.
Right.
There's a couple things that structurally are a little more difficult, a little more challenging. Microsoft, just like Amazon, uses the argument that, there's not enough customer demand.
Although you've just described an internal customer demand.
Yeah. I've described an internal customer demand. It is high on the list, but, they've got a lot of other things that they want to solve on the networking side before they get to V6, and they feel like they might be able to do V6 at a later date. I've been trying to convince Albert Greenberg over at Microsoft, to change that, but, we'll see. And Albert owns, networking in Azure. So, everyone send him an email. No, just kidding. don't do that. But, get me in a lot of trouble.
Yes. And again, it seems to me like that would be almost a marketing opportunity to say, hey, we're the cloud that supports V6. Here's your advantages if you go that way.
They're not a first mover. I mean, SoftLayer, who's now owned by IBM, has had dual stack for a long time. So there are other people that have beaten them to the market on the V6 side. I don't know if it's necessarily a differentiator. And I think the services they do want to work on are they want to spend their time and energy, especially on the Azure team, probably catching up with the features that are offered from AWS. So they have parity. So I get that. I understand it. Same time, the V6 stuff is going to come up and bite people probably a little sooner than they anticipated.
Yeah, it's getting faster. Well, and AWS has this problem too, then.
Yeah, AWS doesn't have V6 either, except for they do have a Elastic Load Balancer you can put V6 VIPs on, so you can do a V6 to a V4 sort of transition.
Right.
So you can get V6 turned up at the edge.
So for a customer that has V6, they're able to go through that edge device, but it's V4 all internally.
Yeah. So V4, you would run all your VPC inside of Amazon as V4 resources, everything else, and then you just have basically a V6 edge component that allows you to translate from V6 to V4 and V4 to V6. Right. Yeah, it's not super painful to get something stood up, which is what I'm sort of hoping out of the Azure team, is that they at least at a minimum get that going.
Well, and like I said, it's create the appearance of supporting V6, but it seems to me that internally they'll have the better benefit anyway. They're going to have the Comcast problem too.
Yes, yeah.
They've got a lot of data centers. They've got a lot of traffic moving around. They're already doing goofy things with routing.
Yeah, they're already doing goofy things with routing, although some of this is taken care of by overlays too, right? So that's the sort of strength of where MVGRE fits and being able to do some overlay things that, you can keep redeploying on the same RFC 1918 space and abuse it to no beats end and not have to worry about.
We really have beaten IPv4 to death, haven't we? Like nothing of what it was designed to do.
The poor thing is stretched pretty thin at this point. I have to admit, I'm amazed at how much time and energy people are willing to put into
stretching V4.
Yeah, keeping what they have going versus just adopting V6.
If you put that energy into just adopting this, a whole lot of stuff goes away. Routing gets so much simpler.
Yeah, we get a new set of problems, but I don't think those problems are anywhere near as bad as the ones we have. So how's that?
And you sort of casually mentioned this, but that multicast is an issue. Like, I always thought multicast solved issues, that it created them.
Well, multicast at scale
creates
issues. Multicast just locally on your own local network is not a big deal.
Right.
And actually, that's how IPv6 actually does things like neighbor discovery, which is how we discover who's adjacent to us on a layer 2 network.
Yeah.
So things like that, that all utilizes multicast. You can't tell the difference between multicast and broadcast on a layer 2 network effectively.
Yeah.
So that's not a big change. I think the interesting things are operator issues. They're not actually anything to do with the protocol as much as how the IETF and some other agencies decided to actually make some design decisions about the implementations for the protocol and not taking as much things into consideration about how we operate V4 networks today. That's a bigger challenge.
Interesting. Is a disconnect between these working groups that maybe aren't running large infrastructures the way a Comcast or an Azure are running, and are just unaware of what it takes to manage them. And so they've set limits inside of how the protocol works.
No, it's not a limit on the protocol. Here, let's go through an example, because that's probably more useful. So today, when you you know, set up your own little Wi-Fi router at home, and you get everything set up. You set up a quick DHCP pool with IPv4, and right. it sends out addresses, and in addition, it provides things like DNS, right?
Yep.
It provides all that information so that when a host comes online, it knows where the default gateway is. It knows a DNS server. It knows how to get an IP address, and bang, you're up on the network. And this is true regardless of whether you're using NAT or not. So this isn't even a NAT situation. You could hand out global, you know, IPv4 addresses this way. Well, in the IPv6 world, we have DHCP v6. Okay.
Yep.
DHCP v6 does not pass out a default gateway. That's a function of the router that's on the local network, which is done through what's called an RA. So there's automatically a decoupling between what DHCP v6 and DHCP provide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't horrible.
No, you just have to know the difference.
Yeah. And then DHCP v6 also provides DNS information. However, not all the clients actually use DHCP v6. Some of them use something called Slack only. And Slack is a stateless way of basically assigning myself an IPv6 address. And I can get the default gateway because I get the RA on the network. And therefore, I'm able to get up and operating. But I have no DNS information. And so they decided to come up with a new standard. It's RFC 6106, which actually allows me to publish DNS information through the RA. But I already have this mechanism in DHCP v6.
Right.
And so if I have a DHCP v6 client, I can get DNS information. So basically, the only holdout on DHCP v6 on the client side is Android. So here it is. You're setting up a wireless network, enterprise or otherwise, and you want to be able to give your host an IP address and allow it to get DNS information and get a default gateway. Now you have to have set up two services in order to make sure that all your hosts are actually able to get up and operate.
Right. Because you DHCP v6, the sensible one, the one that people would think of.
Right.
And then you've got Slack, auto discover of RA, which now also has to provide DNS.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it becomes this weird mix of like, well, operationally, which one do I run? Well, actually, if you're a big enterprise and you're running a wireless network, you're going to have to run both.
Yes.
Because those Android handsets aren't going to be able to get the DNS information.
Because the Android doesn't do DHCP v6. Because why would they?
Oh, man. So it's just a big mess from an operational standpoint. It's not pretty. I wish the Android folks would just get on board with the DHCP v6 client and get that solved. It would certainly address that. And then the counterpoint is that all the folks on the other side of the equation that are Slack RA fans,
yeah,
are saying, you know, Windows does not support RFC 6106.
So it worked. Problem the other way too. You have to run both then.
You have to run both.
That's
so here we are. If you're an operator and you're looking at this, you're going, wow, this is the biggest mess I've ever seen.
Yeah, you guys
got to
get your crap together. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, mea culpa. I don't blame them.
No,
right?
I totally understand.
Yeah.
Hey, Ed, give me 1 second here to pay the bills because Run As Radio is brought to you by ScriptRock, the makers of Guardrail and the fighters of Configuration Drift. Configuration Drift happens in every environment from 5 nodes to 5,000. Guardrail will find and scan the configs of every node in your environment, no matter the platform, and alert you to changes happening across machines. Give it a try for 3 months free with the coupon code RunAsRadio, all one word, at scriptrock.com/RunAsRadio. You know, this is not that crazy. Our old networking stacks in IPv4, especially in the Microsoft space, when we had WINS, you know, like we had a few extra services there to help bridge gaps as well.
Yeah, there's not as much efficiency in the V4, V6 space for bridging this gap.
Right.
And that's I don't think that's necessarily something that Microsoft would be looking to solve. And I don't think that's something that's going to change. I've spoken with several individuals at Microsoft around, you know, saying, hey, are you going to support RFC 6106? And they're like, why? Everyone operationally supports DHCP v6.
Right.
That's the way it should be going forward. That matches all the operational models that everyone has already deployed v4 with.
Righteousness sucks, man.
Yeah. And so I'm sort of like, all right, I get it. And here we are.
But it's just not, I mean, we're talking about running two services to provide a common set of networking services. Like, it's just, that's not, I would like it to be one, but if it's two, it's two. So what?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's identical. It's twice as much work. That's the problem. And it's prone to error, right? You have the wrong DNS server on one side and you got the right one in the other, and then you have no idea.
But that's a tooling problem, right? Like, all we've got to do is get to a place where it is one set of services that serve both sets of information. So there is one place to enter the data.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that. I'm just saying, the maturity wise, you know, the V6
community, we're not quite there yet. But is that the only problem? There's got to be worse.
Yeah, there's a few worse. I mean, well, so there's a lot of operational models around NAT today, right? We all use NAT.
Yeah, but I thought that was what IPv6 was going to get us away from.
Yeah, yeah. And then you get into the thing of, like, you get the one small business guy who says, I need to be dual homed with two service providers and I want different addressing space, but I don't want to run BGP.
Right.
All right. Because I'm not big enough. I don't need that, but I need to be highly available, or I need to have two internet connections. What do you do on your host side? Well, today, the way we solve that in IPv4 is we run NAT. We run a single RFC 1918 space. Let's say, you know, 10.10.10. Whatever.
Yep.
With a /24. And then we simply just NAT to the whatever specific public IPv4 space we use on each one of the devices. And we have some simple little algorithm that watches one versus the other and says, oh, this one's down right now. Flip over and use the other one. And this is mainly for outbound connections for us to get to the internet. Well, in V6, when you have global unicast addresses spread throughout your entire network, and you're going to have one set of global unicast addresses from, you know, Comcast, and another set from, you know, whoever else, AT&T, which one do you actually give to the host?
Well, whichever one is up at the time.
Well, my question to you is, why don't we just give them both?
Yes.
Okay, so let's give them both. Let's work through this problem together, Richard. Mm-hmm. So we give them both, and then we have to come up with an algorithm that tells me which one to use as my sourcing address, depending on what my destination is. Right?
Yep.
Because I've got two addresses on the same interface. Let's say we're just connecting these both up through either wired or wireless. So I need to make some decisions about where I need to go. And believe it or not, we have written several RFCs about this. Not we, but the industry. So the original RFC was 3484, and that RFC has since been updated with a newer one, 6724. And 6724 has this multi-stage decision matrix process that you have to go through in order to determine which sourcing address you're going to utilize to get to a particular destination. And the basic rule of thumb is, you can use RAs. The RAs for the default gateway can actually have preferences, sort of, you know, high, medium, low. You obviously want to use the one that has a higher preference. And then you sort of go down to a thing called a longest prefix match, which is who has the longest match criteria to match the source to the destination. And that address is the one you should use. Well, you could imagine, as a network engineer, this is not really where you want the decision process happening. It's on the host, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want hosts running around deciding where the heck they want to, you know, how they want to, which address they want to source from and which default gateway they want to utilize in order to get that traffic there. I don't think the server guys mind so much, but I definitely say the network people probably are not super keen on that.
Right.
And so suddenly they're asking for, well, how can I assign just a single address down to the host, but still give them capabilities to fail back and forth between them? And now we end up with something that looks like NAT again.
Right. Yeah, give me an abstraction and I'll decide at the moment of transmission where to route it to.
Right, which of course breaks the whole end-to-end game.
Yeah, again. And all of the advantages.
Yeah, yeah. So here we are back with the same mess. It's an interesting process.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and it's all of the question of the decision-making process. Which one of these should I use?
Right. I mean, for enterprises, this is large scale enterprise. This is actually pretty easy. You're going to use BGP. You're going to have a single address block that's assigned to you from Aaron or Ripe or APNIC or whoever. And you're just doing routing as routing. And actually, your life is pretty great.
Yeah. It's the small guy who's had this capability from the perversion of IPv4 with NAT.
You know, right.
That has been able to, and I'm one of them. You know, I've got three different, ISP services coming into the here with a little Cisco router, and it does a great job, but it absolutely relies on that abstraction.
Yeah. And I get it. I mean, I get it how important that is for small businesses. So,
sure.
You know, it's, we do have a version of NAT that's available for V6. It's called NPT V6, network prefix translation. And network prefix translation really is all about just translating the prefix bits and not the host bits.
Right.
And so it's very, very fast and it's stateless. That's the nice thing about it.
Yeah. But it does mean a different set of deploys, I gotta think.
It's actually not horrible, but the thing you have to remember is that if the application stack isn't aware of the fact that some sort of NAT is gonna happen, you can have some some not some great things going on in terms of, you know, applications behaving badly.
Well, remember when NAT first came along for IPv4 and all kinds of apps went berserk.
Yeah, I would say today that it's probably not going to be as big of an issue because we have such robust sort of NAT-enabled stacks on, yeah, on networking equipment that it's not that big of a deal. But the reality is that it's still a NAT. It's still doing some sort of network translation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting problems. I mean, these are operator problems, right? How we want to operate our network. It has nothing to do with the protocol, right?
No, the protocol is, but that's what matters. Implementation is what matters. How do we deliver this kind of service?
If it's not easy to implement, you're not going to adopt it.
And we don't want to mess with BGP here, right? Like, you don't want to actually say, well, why doesn't everybody be a BGP endpoint?
A scaling problem, right? Yeah. With having too many people on the BGP backbone.
Yeah, that system is not designed to scale that easily. Becoming a BGP player is hard and it's complicated.
I actually don't think it's hard. I think the problem is that you're trusting too many people not to make mistakes.
Yes.
It's complex to do BGP right.
Yeah, because it's like everything else on the internet, it's a trusting protocol.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think the big challenge with BGP is to do it right, you actually have to invest time and energy to do it. Mm-hmm. You can do it simply, but a lot of people do it wrong, and you get a lot of mistakes. And a lot of other people have to do a lot of work to sort of protect against you making mistakes.
Yes.
So that just puts more effort and time in for everyone involved in the process. I think the challenge will be for companies to decide, do we actually make good use of that high availability? Is it a high availability or do we just need more bandwidth? And if you just need more bandwidth, there's different ways to solve that.
Sure. Now, when you're out on the edge of the connecting pools here, having different connections go down on a regular basis, it's just sort of life, right?
Yes, yeah. And now with such fast mobile networks, right? I mean, with LTE, the speeds that LTE is providing.
Especially when the antenna is fixed. When you're not using a phone as a phone, if you're actually in a location where it can really get it right, LTE is stunning.
Yes, it's absolutely amazing the speeds they're getting out of all that stuff. And you look at that and you sort of wonder, you know, like, why am I still stuck on DSL or
exactly,
or even some of the lower cable services? It's like, why would you bother if you can actually get that sort of speed and performance out of that? Now, granted, there's bills associated with it, but
oh yes,
you know, I mean, I think it's worthwhile especially for a lot of the businesses that are doing interesting things. And this is for me the most interesting part. I'm getting a chance to work on a V6 project that is with a company that makes very large construction equipment. And they're talking about, you know, IoT and internet enabling everything.
Right.
Out of the manufacturing floor, which is sort of wild.
Yeah, no kidding.
That would be pretty cool to be able to talk about, you know, that sort of scale V6 deployments and what they're doing and the sort of sensor networks that they're building on those devices and amount of data they're collecting. Anyone who's in the whole, you know, big data analytics game, this is a game changer when you start changing that from the manufacturer floor versus trying to go back and sort of post retrofit everything.
Well, suddenly everybody's running tens of thousands of devices. The devices are very small and light, but it's, you know, those are a lot of IPs.
Yes.
And so everything you've ever heard about scaling IP management is applicable to everybody.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, I'm excited. V6 has a bunch of efficiencies built in for these very small networks and or very small sort of segmented networks. But then in addition, also in terms of how the protocol stack actually works. Mm-hmm. And there's huge advantages of having global addresses on these devices. And there's downsides too. I mean, the big advantage is that you can build devices that can go to sleep for much longer periods of time and still know that they're, you know, that when they wake up, their address is still
going to
work.
They're okay. They know who to talk to. They know how to talk. Nobody's talking over them. Like, that's all good.
Yeah, all that stuff is good. So, you know, the sleep times and the battery save is huge. The downside is obviously you got a global address on there, so anyone can access it. But you put the right same stateful firewall components in place, stateful packet inspection. That's no different than V4 or V6. It allows you to segment off networks that people really shouldn't be accessing. Things like, you know, power grids that people shouldn't be playing with anyway.
No. You know, I'm at a point now in my house where I'm looking at different subnets for household devices like thermostats and telephones and things like that, separate from computing devices, separate from the guest network, you know, and I've been looking, you know, this is my house.
Yeah.
But it's hundreds of devices now.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's are you playing with Nest? Are you playing with anything equivalent? I mean, that's
six that zone is, heating. Yes.
Yeah, so yeah,
that's, I need six IPs so cool. for Nest, three for the smoke and CO2 detectors. Mm-hmm. The phones are all PoE, so that's, you know, and bit by bit I'm looking and going, wow, I've got 40, 50 devices that are just house stuff, you know, mm-hmm. the sprinklers and the temperature sensors, and like it adds up.
Yeah, and your garage door, you got the remote door openers, you got the remote sensors and monitoring cameras.
Yeah, and the cameras, like that piece, then actual devices. But, you know, my daughter throws a party and 30 more IPs get consumed on the DHCP stack because everybody comes in with a phone.
Right. And then, well, no. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if they have 15, she has 15 over, that's 30 because they probably all running around with both laptops and handsets or, you know, iPads or whatever
something.
Else. So
exactly. So it's, you know, the guest pool has to be a pretty robust pool too.
Yeah, and they all and your daughter's giving away your Wi-Fi password like it's candy.
There's right? the really secure one she doesn't know, and the one she can give her friends. But that's right. You know, what I like now is that even home-based routers, I got the WRT 1900 AC, which is a pretty sturdy wireless access point, but it's got guest networking built in. You don't have to know anything. Switch on guest network. Done.
Yes, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a brave new world. I think the V6 community gets that. I mean, they're working on a lot of initiatives around sort of the home side, but Comcast just enables it for you automatically.
Right.
That's a thing that I don't know if a lot of people are aware of is if you've gotten a newer DOCSIS 3 modem from Comcast, go poke around. You might be running V6.
You don't even know.
Not even know it.
Well, I kind of like the idea of running V6 for stuff like if all those phones can support V6. Let's put them on a V6 wireless then.
Yeah, so I run dual stack at home, and my family. I've only had a handful of hiccups. My daughter was screaming down to me down the hallway. She's like, "Why is everything showing up in Chinese?" My address block for my V6 address block had been tagged out as being geolocated in Taiwan. And so, everything was showing up as if we were in Taiwan because we were being geolocated that way. So all the services suddenly flipped over. I got that fixed in 24 hours, but still it was rather amazing.
There's a moment for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also get, you know, and I sort of buy corporate's not going to change this. They're going to be forced to because it's all risk, no reward.
Yeah.
Average employee couldn't care less about the network except when it doesn't work.
This is true. This is absolutely true. Plus, they have much higher risk tolerance from the application side, right?
Yes.
They don't know if all their apps actually work.
I mean,
we're consuming stuff on the public internet. That stuff is being updated all the time, consistently being updated.
Yes.
The stuff that we run in corporate enterprise, not so much.
No, not so much. And hundreds of apps. You know, the ecosystem of a mid-sized corporation can easily break 1,000 apps. It is staggering. And the cost to evaluate that is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's justifiable that there's nervousness there. What I think my biggest complaint is, why aren't you investing the time now to start figuring out what's going to bite you later versus waiting to the last possible moment? But that's the CIO's job. That's the CTO's job to sit down and say, hey, you know, we need to start figuring out this roadmap. And I think other things have been distracting, cloud and SDN and network function virtualization, lots of other buzzwords that are going on.
As an advisor to CIOs, I've been doing a fair bit of work on the whole, let's put all these old apps in virtual desktops. And I see that as a wrapper to IPv6, that the app will never know it's living in anything other than this little IPv4 world. But its communication outside of that VM wrapper is going to be all of IPv6.
Yeah, that would be a good strategy. Something people should be paying attention to.
Plus, it's keeping those crazy apps alive. So let me tell you, I'm keeping some cranky software alive these days. Ed, it's so much fun to talk to you. I really appreciate it. You, as usual, are optimistic. But I think you've got some evidence here, too, looking at the World IPv6 Launch.org site. These are real numbers of real companies, many loathe the world around, that are really implementing V6, whether they're telling their customers or not.
Yeah, it's real.
It is the real thing. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.